54 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's morning show, unlikely fare for the morning show, a conversation about zombies, specifically the immense popularity of the television program The Walking Dead, based on a highly acclaimed graphic novel series of the same name. We'll be talking with a psychology professor about what might be at the heart of our collective fascination with zombies. In part two of the program, you're going to be meeting a very, very talented cartoonist for the New Yorker magazine. Stay with us. And now for a topic which we don't discuss all that often on the morning show, zombies, and specifically the zombies which we experience and much more in the most popular scripted series on television right now, The Walking Dead, based upon a groundbreaking graphic novel series. And The Walking Dead returns with new episodes a little bit later this year, but in the meantime, this weekend, it is the premiere of a spin-off series, a prequel of sorts called Fear the Walking Dead. And of course, this is just one of a number of such works which seem to point to a pervasive fascination amongst the general public with zombies and this image of a horrifying post-apocalyptic world populated by zombies with a small band of unaffected humans trying to survive. What's going on here? Why are we so fascinated with this particular genre, with this particular dramatic setup? And what is at the heart of the immense success of The Walking Dead, sometimes called a horror drama? Joining me for this portion of the morning show is Travis Langley, who is an expert in the field of psychology. And he and a number of his colleagues who have a similar fascination with this particular program have their expertise, in a sense, joined together in a book which Dr. Langley has edited called The Walking Dead Psychology, in which this series and its phenomenal success are explored in a number of different respects. Travis Langley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I think it comes through pretty clearly that all of you who have contributed to this book to some extent are also fans of The Walking Dead, although it isn't necessarily so. I mean, there's all kinds of experts who probe into various topics or into the lives of particular people without necessarily admiring them or enjoying them. But the sense here is that, by and large, just about everybody who is a contributor here happens to also be a fan of this show, including you. Can you clarify that for us?
Oh, yes. We are fans. We are trying to write as objectively as we can, but we are talking about something that is intriguing to us. I've been a fan since the first issue, you know, way back when. In fact, you look through the letter column in early issues. I think it's numbers 11, 13, and 17. You'll find letters by me. So I've been analyzing this stuff, you know, for a long time.
I didn't happen to mention that you are a professor of psychology at Henderson State University. How much of your teaching involves topics like this?
Well, Chris, we use examples in everything we ever talk about. You know, you could be taking a math class where somebody's doing a problem with two trains approaching each other and you calculate when they reach each other. For somebody who loves trains, that's a great way to learn math. You know, I use fiction as examples in a number of different classes. Every spring, though, I do a media-related class. So it might be psychology and literature, psychology and film, Batman. You know, I'm the author of the book Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night. And, you know, next spring, it's going to be Psych of the Living Dead.
So the phenomenon of zombies, of course, goes beyond this particular series, the Walking Dead, as I said, based upon an extraordinarily important, groundbreaking comic book series or graphic novel series. But, of course, this isn't brand new. It is riding the crest of what has been a fascination for a while now. Can you just kind of pull that apart? I mean, how much is The Walking Dead, I mean, which is the primary focus of your book, how much is this about that exceptional success, and how much is this about the more overarching interest which a lot of us seem to have in zombies?
Yeah, even as much as we talk about The Walking Dead specifically, there is the interest itself in zombies. In fact, the introduction to the book, or the foreword to the book, is by John Russo, who co-created Night of the Living Dead. In fact, he's the man who invented this kind of zombie, because George Romero, in making the film, he had not been sure what their ghouls were, and John said they should be the recently deceased. So John invented these zombies that we think of, because before that, zombie meant something else. And he, in his entire foreword, is about that issue, why zombies? And in the introduction, I get it, and different writers throughout the book will bring that up too, because it's not just this particular story. This particular story, incredibly well written with rich characters, but the zombies themselves, and they've built an interest over time too. One-third of all zombie movies have come out since 9/11, and I don't think that's a coincidence. 9/11 changed our view of the world and created different fears in a lot of people, and an increased consciousness of, you know, danger and a view of what life itself is like. And I think there is some concern about what is happening with the world. Now, if you're looking at a story of, you know, an Ebola outbreak, all right, that is in the real world and can be additionally uncomfortable. You're looking at a story with zombies, though, you know it can't happen, no matter how bad it gets. And no matter how much it has to do with real issues of, well, what would survival be like if a post-apocalyptic situation came along? You know, no matter how much it has to do with the real issues, we still know, most of us know, that can't happen.
Right. And so it can be a horrifying thing to watch, but it isn't sort of deeply unsettling in the sense of, wow, what if this happens to us someday? When typically when people are watching something like The Walking Dead, they are not watching it with that sort of fear connected to it, the fear that this fate could befall me.
Right. If you're watching something about a plague or your war, your conflict with another country, those do touch on real concerns, real fears. And The Walking Dead touches on them too, but with that filter of fiction. Like when I teach a forensic psychology class, you know, I can get into some of the most comfortable topics in the world. I can be talking about brutal crime, and sometimes the unpleasantness of it is such a turnoff or so uncomfortable for the students that they miss the point of what I'm trying to teach. I can talk about the same lessons, but with a fictional example, and they listen and they get it.
Hmm. I have to say, probably my favorite thing in this whole genre, and maybe it doesn't fit exactly precisely, but something like 28 Days Later or World War Z, where there is that element of the plausible sort of woven in, makes it, in a sense, even more deeply disturbing, which also means I find it, I can't return to it in the same way or enjoy it exactly on the same level.
Yeah, you can find it intriguing. It's like, I love 28 Days Later and World War Z, but they're not fun the same way. We could have the horrible things happen in The Walking Dead, but there's also this fun to it.
Right. And, of course, one of the things that somebody points out in the book is that when we have these foes, these enemies, who, in a sense, are no longer human, at least in one sense they are, then they can be killed, in a sense, more indiscriminately. They are more like something that pops up in a video game rather than face-to-face with another human being. They, in many cases, were once human. In some cases, it's somebody we can identify, and yet they are something else now, human and yet distinctly non-human. I think that's what you say in your chapter, and that, in a sense, injects a bit of fun and freedom into this.
Yeah, it's like, why isn't it a vampire apocalypse? Well, vampires, they range as to how they're being depicted as to whether they are still the original person or not, but they retain some personality and character of some sort. And right there, you know, that's a level of humanizing them that we don't get with those zombies. Those zombies are not human anymore.
Another point which is made that had not really dawned on me, but I think it's really true, and it also helps explain the interesting success of other series that have nothing to do with zombies, series like The Dome or Fallen Skies, which involve other sorts of events, but they share with The Walking Dead and some of these other zombie post-apocalyptic scenarios this idea of returning to the primitive, of stripping away from our lives so many of the modern conveniences, which on some level a lot of us find, in a sense, disconcerting. Talk about how important that is for the dramatic impact of a show like The Walking Dead.
Yeah, it is disconcerting. What if we lose all these things we have? But there's also something strangely appealing about the idea of a worldwide do-over. You know, what if just suddenly, you know, the horrible crisis happened? Well, that would also mean that you wouldn't have to pay your credit card bills. You know, that you would be free from some of the constraints of the life that you'd had with a new horrible situation, but it's still an odd sense of a fresh start, a new circumstance.
Right. And, of course, a return to who we really are when we no longer are sitting in front of our laptop or plugged into our smartphones, when so much of that is stripped away, what's left? Another really intriguing chapter in the book talks about how this is very much about the systems that spring up between people, particularly people under duress trying to survive. Talk about that term of systems and how that ends up adding kind of a whole layer of fascinating detail to something like The Walking Dead.
Because The Walking Dead is not a story of just one guy wandering through a world full of zombies. It is, you know, the story of one man who was looking for his family and forms an enlarged adopted family, this system of people, this connection among them and how they are related and how they work together and what they've created among themselves as this set of people. Because it's a recurring theme in there, you know, fight the dead, fear the living, which is pretty cynical sounding, but, you know, even as much as their fellow human beings can be the greater danger, they also keep hitting on the fact that they need their fellow human beings. They've got to find like-minded people to pull together. And in this situation, you find out very quickly who has your back and who does not. Unlike, you know, our world with our everyday niceties where you're not always really sure what they're saying about you behind your back.
Mm. In one of the chapters that you wrote, you explore some of the principles of the great Sigmund Freud and how the whole matter of defense mechanisms comes into play in something like this, in such a horrific situation where people find themselves suddenly under such stress in completely unanticipated ways, and the ways in which different people react to the same sort of peril in very different ways. That's not just the fantasy of writers, but on some level seems to be based on what we understand about human beings and the defense mechanisms which we construct under such circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I am absolutely not a Freudian. There are plenty of things where he was being creative but lacked evidence. But the defense mechanisms are an area where a lot of us give him a lot of credit. We really do play tricks on ourselves. We really do lie to ourselves sometimes, or you know, find a way to redirect our frustrations. You're mad at your boss, so you go punch the punching bag, you know, instead of punching your boss. You know, we have a whole set of these things, and these different characters, some of them use the defense mechanisms in very healthy ways as a way of channeling their frustration and fears. Some of them do it in unhealthy ways. You know, this past season, when Father Gabriel is cautioning the leader of Alexandria that, you know, Rick and his people are not to be trusted. You know, they'll just do for themselves. He's projecting, you know, his own assessment of himself onto them as a way to feel better or try to deal with it by, you know, seeing it in other people, among the long list of things. Some defense mechanisms can even take a person in kind of a psychotic direction where Rick is hallucinating as his way of dealing with grief and loss. So some are very healthy, some are healthy when used right, and then some are just unhealthy.
Right. And, of course, the book also explores things like post-traumatic stress disorder. You must, as you examine this show, come away so admiring the good work of its creators, I mean, who have created a show that is so psychologically sound, in a sense.
I've always been a fan of the comic book series and Robert Kirkman and his story, but it's not just him. There's so many people writing the stories and directing, and the actors do such a wonderful job of bringing humanity to these characters. I am impressed, yes.
The book is The Walking Dead Psychology, Psych of the Living Dead, edited by Travis Langley, published by Sterling. Professor Langley, it was great to talk with you. I enjoyed your book very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Part two of the Friday Morning Show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. If, like me, you are a reader of The New Yorker magazine, then you have surely enjoyed the fantastic cartoons which appear as a very regular and really indispensable feature of that great publication. And if you look at The New Yorker and enjoy the cartoons, then you have certainly enjoyed the very innovative original work of Matthew Diffie. And as a matter of fact, I've had the pleasure of speaking with Matthew Diffie before because of a series of books which he edited called The Rejection Collection. There's at least two of these volumes of cartoons which were submitted to The New Yorker, but for various reasons not chosen for publication, sometimes because of appropriateness or other matters, but cartoons which nevertheless deserve to be seen and were then seen by the public in these books called The Rejection Collection. And now Matthew Diffie offers up a book which is his own work start to finish, and the book is titled Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. in which he collects some of his very best work that has appeared in New Yorker magazine, and some brand new work which has never appeared in any way, shape, or form before this. It's a great book, start to finish. And despite the challenge of talking about such a visual medium as cartooning over the radio, I'm excited about this conversation and about talking with Matthew Diffie about the book. Again, it's called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People, published by Scribner. And Matthew Diffie, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be back here.
Before we talk about this book, I would love to learn a little bit about your background as an artist and where it all began for you. I mean, as a youngster, were you somebody who was more interested in scribbling pictures and writing caricatures than anything else in your life? Or at what point did art really become kind of a consuming passion for you?
Yeah, well, I was definitely that kid in class that was always drawing. You know, I humbly say that I was always kind of gifted at it. I mean, I was. You know, I was always a little better than the kids around me. I don't take that for granted. That makes you want to do it. When you're good and you get a little praise or a little attention for it, it makes you do something even more. So I was always drawing. I got better than I was when I was five, but I was always a little better than the others. So, you know, I drew all along, and I guess when I got serious about it, maybe in high school, I started entering art contests through school and stuff. And at that point, I wanted to be a wildlife artist. I grew up in Texas and then later North Carolina. And, you know, hunting is a big part of the culture down there, and just appreciation of nature and stuff. So that was my first sort of direction. So I learned how to draw, you know, all kinds of animals, which still show up sometimes in my cartoons. And then through school, I got interested in, you know, fine art, which was my real career plan, you know, to be a painter, to be a, you know, even at the end, an abstract sort of expressionist type, you know, painter. Big oil paintings and stuff, and try to get them in galleries. And it was only after, you know, doing that for 10 years and at the same time trying to be a comedian, because those were my two main interests, trying and not quite succeeding for literally, I think, 10 years or so, that I even thought about becoming a cartoonist.
Wow. It's fascinating to me that you have this aspiration to be just about as different an artist as one could imagine from the kind of artwork that you do now. Not that the artwork itself doesn't matter in what you do, but it just feels like a whole different planet. How scary a leap was that to step away from what you had done and into this new arena of cartooning?
It wasn't scary at all. It was sort of I just felt like an idiot for not thinking of it earlier. Because, like I say, I was doing both parts of it and, you know, aggressively. I was very interested in comedy, you know, doing stand-up. I had a sketch comedy team and, you know, would just read and study everything about it. So I was, you know, I was a deep, deep comedy nerd. And also, you know, an art nerd. And the fact that it never occurred to me, oh, you can do both at the same time, is still kind of embarrassing to me.
Right.
So, yeah, I was 29 when I first put it together, and that was because I saw a New Yorker. The New Yorker had their first ever sort of cartoon-themed issue in 98, I think. And they had a contest in there that you were supposed to send in a cartoon idea. It was the New Yorker and the Algonquin Hotel. They co-sponsored the contest, and you had to do a cartoon about hotel life, whatever that is. So I entered the contest and ended up winning the contest, and Bob Mankoff, who's the cartoon editor at the magazine, he was the judge of the contest. So that was my toe in the door, and then I started submitting cartoons, you know, the week after that.
And you basically broke the door down at that point.
Well, I don't know about that. I sold the first year I did, we're supposed to do 10 a week. Ideas, you know, sketched up that we pitch. Not really pitch, we just send them in. And I was going to be the impressive young kid, so I was doing 15 every week. And the first year I sold 4.
Oh.
So.
Okay. So.
I don't know if.
Break down the door is not a good phrase, at least for that first
maybe,
year.
You know, I chipped away at the door, made a little mouse hole under the door, and then eventually widened that till, a little more every year, and then. Here I am today, 15 years, I guess, later.
So tell us kind of whatever you think is interesting for us to know about your process. I think that's probably for those of us who are on the outside, very much looking in, peering in through the window and wondering how in the world these wonderful cartoons take shape. As far as we can tell, it involves a lot of sitting and staring into space and thinking, and mm-hmm. Until some idea just kind of magically appears. I suspect that's not exactly the process.
Well, it is the process. I think most people don't think about that. I think most people assume that we get ideas just from life, walking around or hearing people say things at parties, and we just jot it down. And that does happen, and for others maybe more than me. But, yeah, for me it's just what you said. I sit down with a pot of coffee and an empty sheet of paper, and I just, force myself to drum up ideas and turn through a ton of really terrible ideas to get, a couple kernels that are worth something. And I guess maybe the surprising thing to people that it's hard for us to. Most people talk to will be like, oh, I can never do that. And I think behind that comment is the assumption that it must be a lot easier to be creative for creative people. And I don't buy that. All the creative people I know work really hard at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that would be a surprise. The other thing is that you kind of hinted at it a moment ago. It's way more about, the ideas than it is the drawing. Most cartoon, when you hear a cartoon, you think of the drawing because that's the end product, what people see. But that's, 10% of the work. 90% of the work is really the writing, I guess, the coming up with the concepts.
One of the things that strikes me as different from the work of someone who has a comic strip for which they're responsible. I mean, just a week or two ago, I spoke with someone actually from here in Southeast Wisconsin who has a nationally syndicated comic strip. And in talking about kind of the gauntlet that represents in terms of a persistent, perpetual deadline and a certain number of strips you simply must produce, the impression I get from what you do is, if there's anything that's maybe in some sense a little easier about what you do, is that you don't have that. That you're not responsible for a prescribed number of comic strips each and every week or month or whatever. On the other hand, because you don't have an ongoing comic strip, each and every panel that you are creating has to be, in a sense, a truly original, absolutely from scratch creation, from the ground up, and that seems incredibly daunting.
Yeah, I don't know which is harder. I have lots of friends, of course, that do strips, and I've never done it because it seems like a lot, because you have to write and draw a strip every day, and it depends on your drawing style, what your characters look like, but that's hours of work. But also, there's nothing more frustrating than drawing an idea that you're not crazy about. And I think if I had to come up with an idea every day and publish it, a lot of them would be ideas I'm not crazy about. It's just hard to come up with something solid and great every day. So in that sense, what we do is way better. I'd rather, because I just need one. I'll do the 10 sketches that I have to turn in, but really, they're hardly ever going to buy more than one, if that. So I just have to have one idea, really, a week. Of course, I generate tons to get that one good one, but it would be nice. When you see strips that carry out like sort of ongoing storylines, that would be kind of nice, because you can just kind of chunk them together and feed off of, not just the storyline that you've got built, but also just the characters you've established. And I think it leads to more jokes. Or not more jokes, but a different kind of joke. A joke where people enjoy it just because it's coming from that particular character.
Absolutely.
And they know that character so well. So, that's what we aren't able to do in The New Yorker. We have to reinvent the whole scene, the whole setup, the whole environment, and all the new characters. And also get them across in however many seconds somebody's going to look at the cartoon. So I guess that part's harder. I don't know. I guess I could have done the other, but I just ended up here, and it suits me, I guess. I've always enjoyed just one-off, one-liner type jokes. When I was doing comedy, that was the stuff I gravitated to as well, and I think this is the cartoon equivalent of that.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Matthew Diffie, who is a well-known cartoonist for The New Yorker magazine. And we spoke previously about a series of a couple different books called The Rejection Collection, which involves what you were just talking about, Matthew Diffie, cartoons not just submitted by you, but by all kinds of different people, submitted to The New Yorker, rejected for one reason or another, and you gathered some of those rejected cartoons into these really entertaining books. And we're talking today about your newest book called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People, which we'll get to in just a second. Do you find yourself, speaking of rejected cartoons, going back to rejected cartoons and trying to submit them with a little bit of tweaking or redrawn or recast altogether? Or, by and large, do rejected cartoons remain rejected in a sense?
No, I definitely go back. I think we all go back. There's even a term. We call it a resubmission. And, you know, often, having edited my own edited cartoons on my own books and other projects, I understand how flimsy the decisions can be in some ways, just based on, you know, what's going on that week and how many you've got coming in from other people. And there's plenty of good cartoons that just don't get bought for the silliest reasons. So it's always good to bring them back, and Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor, is happy to see them. Usually, it becomes a point, of course, where you've brought them back, you know, 8 years in a row, and then maybe it's time to let that one go. But I've sold a few cartoons that way, either bringing them exactly the way they were, just it's a better timing sort of thing, so they buy them, or like you say, you know, making minor changes. Because sometimes, you know, if you don't look at a cartoon that, you know, at the time you loved, if you set it aside for 6 months and then look at it again, it's amazing how clearly you see its flaws and can hopefully, you know, oh, it needs to be this, or this person needs to be talking, or I drew them wrong, you know, they need to have this look on their face. And, you know, sometimes just those tiniest changes can make the, you know, a so-so idea work well. Hmm. So, yeah, we totally do that. And that's why, you know, sometimes it was hard to get stuff for the rejection collection, because people are always still holding out hope that the, you know, the idea would sell.
Right. So. And I really appreciate the observation that you made earlier in the interview that one of the things that really makes a cartoon successful, especially the kind of cartoons that show up in The New Yorker, is it needs to be a cartoon that, in a sense, at a glance, can make its point. Because sometimes a glance is all that you can count on getting from a given reader. One of my favorites
Well, go ahead. I was just going to say more about that. Just the if you think about, even myself, if you think about how much time you spend with a cartoon, it's probably way less than you imagine. Like you look at the drawing for like, what, 1, 2, 3 seconds maybe? And then you jump to the caption, you read that, and then you either get the joke immediately because you've already seen the visual, or you jump back up to the visual for another couple seconds. Maybe you spend 5 seconds with a cartoon, and that's depressing in a way. Why do I spend hours drawing them? But anyway, you were gonna say something else about another.
Well, I was just gonna mention one of my favorite cartoons from this new book called Hand Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. You have them collected by topic matter, subject matter,
mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because I happen to be a religious person myself. I turned right away to chapter 12, which is for smart, attractive, religious people. And you have some really great things here, including one cartoon that's of a guy, bespectacled guy, sitting on looks like a subway train in New York City. And he's wearing a T-shirt which says, "Ask me about my religion," and the heading right above it is, "Another way to keep an empty seat beside you on the train."
Yeah, totally works.
I lived in
New York for 12 years. Those are kind of street savvy things. Another thing that'll work, interestingly enough, is if you put a French fry on each side of yourself.
Okay.
Notice that, because people, it's an aggressive, like if you're sitting between two French fries, like parentheses or potato parentheses, people that come in and think about sitting there, but they'd have to flip the French fry away, and that's a pretty aggressive move. If because the guy, I'm sitting there, so they're obviously right in my face saying, hey, move your french fry. And, you know, you try to avoid aggressive moves in the subway. So I found that that is very handy. Two french fries will keep beside you.
Whatever
you
it did.
You know, pour some water in the seat. I've done that.
Right.
I haven't done that, but I actually did that in a mysterious puddle on the subway my first week in New York. It was a classic rookie mistake. I didn't even see it. You know, it just sort of blends in with the fluorescent lighting and stuff. And I was like, oh, there's an empty seat. And I sat down in it and then immediately hopped up. And I was like, oh, no, I sat in water. Expecting, you know, all the New Yorkers to kind of laugh with me. And nobody laughed. Nobody looked at me. It was a welcome to New York in a way.
Right.
Anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about subway seats.
Because one of the points I drew from this whole chapter devoted to various religious-themed comic strips or comic panels or cartoons is not a single one offended me in the least. And I'm not speaking on behalf of all religious people everywhere,
yeah.
but I was impressed that you could be so funny without, it seems to me at least, poking an unreasonable amount of fun at the notion of religion, something which a fair number of people feel very seriously about. And yet, I wonder how much you think about that, not just with cartoons that happen to be about religious themes, but panels that are going to be about anything that might be a topic that people care about. How much do you worry about people being offended or even angered by something that you might write or draw?
Well, yeah, I appreciate you saying that because that is important to me. I don't want to be a mean guy. I'm not a mean guy. I know some cartoons actually set out to provoke people and instigate, you know, I guess be preachy in a way. And I don't have any bent towards that. And, you know, there's easy topics that you can do that, you know, make fun of people. Make fun of religious people in this case or whatever. You know, there's tons of different weird chapters in here. But, you know, there's also a smart joke that you can make that's about things on a bigger, larger level than just, you know, isn't this person stupid or isn't this type of person idiotic or, I don't know, I don't like that. I also, you know, I grew up religious, so I have a lot of respect for it.
Right.
You know, the good of religion is great. And it's just the human part, really, that gets messed up, I think, in most cases.
Sure.
The organized humans that throw things off, but the baseline idea of religion is good.
At any rate, I really enjoyed a lot of those particular cartoons, especially one that has a picture of a building, and it says right on the site, Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses, which, of course, many people are familiar with, and then stuck right in the middle of the front yard is a little sign, no soliciting. So if you know even a little bit about Jehovah's Witnesses, that's a pretty funny cartoon. Maybe not to Jehovah's Witnesses, but...
I wonder. I bet it is. I hope it is. I don't know. Yeah, that's important to me, to be able to touch on topics without being offensive. There's a chapter in the book also for smart, attractive Eskimos and Indians. And I did get one comment on my Amazon page of somebody who just basically categorized the whole book as unfunny. And their whole criticism was, there's a chapter about Indians and Eskimos. And I that drives me crazy, that sort of idea that there's whole topics that we've deemed politically incorrect that you can't discuss or talk about at all, whether the cartoons are thoughtful or smart or non-offensive or not. In my case, you know, I think I tried hard to make jokes without, you know, being mean. And I hope people appreciate that. I'm glad to hear you did.
Right. That's a great chapter, actually. There are a couple of them that I really like. One of them is of two parka wearing fishermen huddled on the ice, sitting on crates. They're fishing into a small circle in the ice, as one would see in the Arctic or Antarctic. And one of them says to the other, "You keep saying ice fishing like there's some other kind."
Yeah.
And that's actually probably a cartoon where we have to look at that for probably more than a second to fully take it in.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I guess that's good because then I, you know, didn't draw in vain. I didn't spend all that time. There's another cartoon in that chapter that probably is most potentially offensive to some, and which is the typical Eskimo in a Eskimo parka, and then there's another one standing right beside him. The first one is labeled Eskimo, and the second one is labeled Eskimo transvestite, and they're dressed identical.
Because that's all that Eskimos ever wear.
Yeah, apparently. That, you know, I mean, it's freezing cold. Why would you go off of the format, off the formula, I guess. But so that, you know, that joke, if you're one of the people who thinks, oh, you just can't make jokes about Eskimos or transvestites, you could just categorically, you know, reject that cartoon. But I'm sympathetic to the transvestite in this situation. So, I don't know why I'm defending myself, even though I'm not being attacked, but I do like discussing these things because, I mean, to me, that's a way to do a joke that is touching on a topic, but in a sympathetic, friendly way.
Right.
But some people just like, you know, some people, if there are some people that are going to be offended by the religion chapter just because I'm doing cartoons about religion. And I think that's a shame. I think it seems like a humorless way to live.
Right.
But, anyway. And
I appreciate the fact too that the, in a sense, the level of simplicity of these cartoons varies to some extent. I mean, as you I think quite rightly said, they all to some extent aim to be relatively simple in the sense of you can take in the humor pretty simply, pretty quickly, which doesn't mean it was a simple matter to create that particular cartoon or that particular image. One of my favorites in terms of what I would think of as kind of humor on the simplest yet most wonderful level is in your chapter, which is all about elderly people, various funny cartoons about elderly people.
And it's attractive.
Right, yes.
Right.
And it's two elderly gentlemen, both in rocking chairs, but one of them, the rocking chair is pitched all the way backwards. So the guy is, in a sense, sprawling on his back, still in the rocking chair, and the caption is just, in quotation marks, a simple word, Gesundheit. You know, that's not Chaucer or anything, but that is a great cartoon, visually. And,
yeah, well, thank you. It's, you know, the brevity is definitely a goal we're going after. It's so nice when you can get a caption that's just one word or a few words, or even a no-word cartoon is nice, but... Yeah, and I love a cartoon that sort of paints the or implies what the frame before it was or after it. You know, it gives a cartoon, which is just a single image, it gives it a little bit more of a life, before and after life.
Right.
Which is nice.
Exactly. I appreciate the fact, too, that we catch, in a sense, what is a glimmer, at least, of your previous life as a stand-up comedian. That the introduction to the book and in some other cases the brief introductions to some of the other sections, it's as though in written down fashion you're giving us little traces of what your stand up career was like. Is that a fair statement? I mean, is that kind of
I don't know. It's definitely not stuff that I used to do as stand up, but it is first person. Kind of comic riffing on the topic. So in that sense, yeah, it is. Maybe I should go back and try stand up and just read these introductions. But that was a desire of mine, but also the publisher and everyone involved to just put a little more personality from the cartoonist, from me, the author, into the book. So it's not just a page after page of a cartoon. It's there's a little bit of a character behind it. Similar to what we were talking about with the strip, you know, because sometimes jokes are funnier if you know the character that they're coming from. So that was the idea, to get a little of me and my thoughts about each chapter, you know, whether it's old people or Eskimos and Indians or lumberjacks, or there's a whole chapter in there about utensils and people who use them.
Right.
Attractive people who use utensils. Isn't everyone.
We should mention that chapter 10 is for smart, attractive, sexy people, and this is where, of course, you get a little bit daring. And I enjoyed this chapter very much as well. Probably my favorite cartoon in this chapter, and one of the best in the book, I think, is on a street. It looks like it's in front of a nice establishment. You know, maybe a very, very nice. luxury apartment in the heart of Manhattan or something, and there's
yeah.
a doorman with his little phone, and standing out at the edge of the sidewalk is a scantily clad blonde woman, and this kind of elderly guy with the phone is looking over at her and asking, and will he know what this is regarding? And there's a whole world caught up in that in yeah. that simple little image and caption.
One of my favorite things, by the way, hearing a cartoon being described over the radio, there's something really actually nice about it. because you're hitting all the exact points that are important. You know, you're describing it in the same way that I think about it as I'm drawing it. You know, I have to draw this person this way and show this, and you're getting it all. So that's nice to, nice to hear somebody, I guess, pay attention.
Right, exactly. So let's finish with maybe one of your favorites.
Oh, man.
Maybe you don't have the book in front of you.
I do have the book in front of me. Let me think here. Oh, it's going to be really hard to pick one. But,
oh, dear.
I mean, I guess my favorites are in some ways in this book are the ones that are not my single panel cartoons, most of which, I guess most of which came from The New Yorker. Some of my favorites are the new pieces that I did just for this book. So one of them is, I'm looking at it now, it's a double page spread in the chapter for Smart Attractive People with Tattoos. And it's, the title is Knuckle Tats You'll Never See. So this is like tattoos across, you know, across the backs of people's fingers, as
oh, right.
some do. I don't know if they're going to, I don't know if it'll read right, but so I've drawn all these different sets of hands, you know, showing their knuckle tattoos. And one of them across his knuckles says, "This hurt." And another one says, "Alan Alda," which would be a funny thing to put a tattoo on your knuckles.
Right.
I don't know. Another one says, "Flautist." I guess the idea of a flautist playing a flute
yeah.
with flautist written on her knuckles.
Not
and
likely to happen.
Is, what?
And not likely to happen. And I don't know right. any flautists who would subject themselves to that. But
yeah, since knuckle tats you'll never see. Then there's another one over here that just says Lutheran. This is fun to me to like figure out what 8-letter words I could come up with and put on here. There's another one that has pudding with an exclamation point to get the fourth
right.
thing. And then one of them, I guess the last one, I'll tell you this one, it has knuckles on both digits. No, both segments of the digits. So there's, instead of just 8 letters across, it has 16. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So across the top of the knuckle, it says fast food, and then across the bottom of the knuckle, it says employee. So it's fast food employee. I don't know. I enjoy doing stuff like that, that the more special double page spread kind of things. And there's a couple other sort of comic book stuff, like my doctor telling jokes was a fun thing to do.
Oh yeah, right. Renaming yeah. certain diseases and disorders and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
This
yeah,
book is just
your doctor was a comedian. Would
yeah.
be horrible, wouldn't it?
It's a blast, start to finish. It really is, and
right.
I hope even through the limits of radio, we've conveyed some of what makes this book so entertaining. Again, it's called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People by Matthew Diffie, one of the major cartoonists for The New Yorker magazine. The book is published by Scribner. Matthew Diffie, it's been great to reconnect with you. Thank you for this wonderful book and for all the other great work you do for The New Yorker, and best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir. It was fun.
Next week on The Morning Show, a lineup of interesting author interviews beginning on Monday with Janice Kaplan, whose new book is called The Gratitude Diaries, How a Year Looking on the Bright Side Can Transform Your Life. She decided she needed to be a more grateful person and for an entire year set about being that and doing that in very concerted fashion, and her entertaining book is the result. On Tuesday, Dr. Michael Roizen, he is a colleague of television's Dr. Oz, and the two of them have written a new book called Staying Young. On Wednesday, British historian Nick Bunker and his book called An Edge of an Empire, which is about, from the British perspective, why the colonies and Great Britain entered into war, the Revolutionary War, which of course ultimately created the United States. Fascinating book. cookbook author Katie Workman on Thursday with Dinner Solved. And a week from today, I'm very excited to be talking with bestselling author Buzz Bissinger about his bestseller, Friday Night Lights, which has just been republished in a special 25th anniversary edition. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's.